Stock Eliminator to the lanes. We need Stock Eliminator to the lanes.
Welcome, everybody, to the Class Racing Podcast with Aaron and Chuck. Introducing your host, RaceToolsDirect.com's own Aaron Allison and the Cobra Jet flying Charlie Downing, better known as Chuck.
The Class Racing Podcast is proudly presented by RaceTools Direct. RaceTools Direct has over 250,000 SKUs in stock and ready to ship. That includes both racing and non-racing tools and equipment. Do you ever need to buy new tools or equipment for your business but are unsure what to get? Our trusted team of racers will assess your needs and recommend the best tool for your budget. We have recently become the sole tool supplier for a racer that owns a large trucking company. We have been able to save them thousands of dollars over their old local sources. Call or text today, 440-941-8533, or visit our website at www.racetoolsdirect.com.
Welcome to the Class Racing Podcast, episode number 15, with Aaron and Chuck. This week we have Austin Williams, the latest 2019 Stock Eliminator U.S. Nationals champ. Hey, Austin, how's it going?
I'm doing well tonight. How are you guys?
Good, man. Thanks for being on.
So we asked Austin to jump on here. He obviously was the latest Indy winner, and Austin's won a bunch of races over the year, but I think this was your first Indy win, correct?
Correct, yeah. It's only the second time I've been to Indy total. I went 5 years ago in 2014 and didn't qualify. So I waited a while and to come back and then brought a car I know would qualify and to make sure and miss that nightmare.
Yeah, and just to let any of you guys know that don't know, Austin, you are from the Texas area. I'm not sure what part.
Yeah, so I'm actually just south of the Dallas area, about 20 minutes from the Texas Motorplex down here in Ennis, Texas. So we'll have the National here at Dallas next month sometime. So that'll be sort of my hometown race.
Excellent, excellent. So yeah, Dallas is a long way from Indy.
Yeah, it's not close.
What's that, about, right, about 16-hour tow then?
Yeah, something like that. I know, you know, I was hoping whenever I left that I left Monday night, and I figure, oh, I'll get there sometime Tuesday, a little afternoon, and I can just go right in and park because they'll be parked by then. But that was not just a pipe dream, I guess.
All right, well, let's stay away from Indy for now. But we'll get right back to it and obviously spend a good amount of time tonight talking about Indy, the big go, obviously one of the biggest races, probably the biggest race of the year for stock, super stock guys. But I wanted to touch on a couple other events that happened throughout the country, both before and after Indy, just to kind of bring some light to some big things that happened. So the week before Indy was the NMCA All-American Nationals at Norwalk Raceway Park. And Charlie's been going to this race for quite a few years, right? Charlie, you went with the Ford Cobra Jet deal?
Yeah, I call that deal. They had the Cobra Jet deal there a couple times. I was fortunate to win that. I called it more like the Millionaire's Challenge because that's really what that is, you know, with the Copos and the Cobra Jet. Everybody gets together and, you know, they put on a nice little race for all the millionaires and, you know, half a dozen guys that can actually drive. But they do a nice job at it. They have a nice lunch and a dinner every day. The NMCA does a really good job of showcasing that thing up and making nice T-shirts for it and making everybody feel welcome.
Yeah, so, you know, I went. We went. It's about 2 hours from home. Norwalk, great place. We figured, what the heck, kind of try it out. And me and my father both ran the stock super stock race that they have. So they have basically a stock super cup combo. But I'd say it's one step ahead. They actually do have some heads up races. They have a little bit of an interesting rule about their heads up races. If you get a heads up race, it is heads up, but you can only go a tenth better than your qualifying run.
Yeah. So yep, a tenth better than your fastest run. Yep.
Yeah. So I thought that was interesting.
That's interesting.
And different, and it kind of makes some sense. So I don't know exactly how I think about that, but, that was pretty cool. and they had a really good field for the stock super stock race. One warning, if you do go run one of their races, they like their stickers, and they give you about 5 or 6 stickers that they make you put on the car before you can go up and qualify. So that was interesting. But
yeah, they're real big on the window decals and everything else there, if my memory is correct.
Yeah, but I tell you what, it was a laid back atmosphere. The people were very nice, you know, very happy to have us there. You know, tech was very laid back. You know, the whole thing was a laid back atmosphere. You know, nobody was in a hurry. It kind of reminded me of IHRA, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you know, kind of back in their glory days. It was like an IHRA, but different, you know, a little bit more laid back. The schedule wasn't as firm, you know, it was just kind of a fun atmosphere. So we ran stock, super stock thing. Me and my father didn't do too good in that. But the winner was Jeff Ross. So kind of the owner or leader of the Buckeye Stock Super Stock Series, Jeff Ross, and his family Mopars were there, and he ended up getting the win in the stock super stock race. And then as Charlie kind of alluded to, we ran the Copo race. They had this year was the 50th anniversary of the Chevrolet 69 Camaro Copo car. So it was pretty cool. Like Charlie said, they had, you know, it was almost more about the party and the banquets and the luncheons and the, you know, dinners than the race to some extent, but it was pretty cool. They had, you know, we went to the dinners and the luncheons, and they had, you know, a guy from Berger Chevrolet that had worked there in 1969 when they, you know, I think Berger had sold the most Copos out of any dealership. And he told a lot of stories about why they ordered them and how they ordered them with what options. You know, it was really cool. And they had, you know, anybody, you know, the who's who of, you know, kind of GM, Copo Racing was there. A lot of guys from GM, you know, all the guys from, you know, Turnkey and Mike Pistelny and all the guys that have, you know, been a big part of the Copo race were there. And then, you know, pretty much anybody that has a Copo, you know, had a lot of presence. So there was about 80 Copos on the grounds. There was actually a couple original 69 Camaro Copos that were running in the race, which I thought was pretty cool. I didn't think there'd actually be any of those that show up. So that was pretty cool. There was a 69 Copo orange, Hugger orange on street tires that was going like 1150s. So that was pretty cool. But they ran it open comp style, so your dial-in was a tenth better than your best qualifying race. And they paid $5,000 to win. So pretty cool event. We were fortunate enough to win the race. And, you know, they actually made you – I think, Charlie, you won the Cobra Jet race a couple times as well, right?
Yeah. Yep.
But, it was pretty cool. They, you know, they had TV cameras in the final and pictures and magazine articles, and they kind of made it as big a deal as it could be. So, you know, it's first time for me running the NMCA, and I would definitely go back. I thought it was you know, a good alternative if you have an off weekend. I think they run a pretty good series. I think they only have, what, about 6 events, Charlie?
Yeah, I think it's 6 or 7. They run the biggest problem like we have with it is they're kind of spread out. You know, there's one in Bradenton, one in Atlanta, one in Bowling Green, one in Memphis, one in Reading, one in Indy, one at Norwalk, one in Chicago. So they're just kind of spread out throughout the country. So it's more of a national event style series. So
yeah.
It's just tough. It's tough to race their points because it's so spread out along with, you know, NHRA and local combo stuff. That's the biggest problem we find with it. It's tough to do 2 or 3 things in a season.
Yeah, have you ever got a chance to run one of their events, Austin?
No, I haven't. I don't really know what the closest one is to me. I guess that would probably be Memphis, but kind of like Charlie alluded to, when I book a 14 NHRA event schedule every year. So by the time I get to off weekends, it's either hitting probably just a local bracket race or, you know, a few hour drive or so to go to a 5 or 10 grander or something like that. And I just kind of fill my schedule with that or just take weekends off because of the grind of the NHRA schedule.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. And usually this race is right on top of Bowling Green, as it was this year. And we usually skip it and go to Bowling Green. But this year, we weren't really doing the points. I wasn't really in the points chase. We decided to try it out. And, you know, good alternative. And just figured we'd touch on it for a few minutes, since I know we talked about it last week that I was going to head up there. So, great race, great weather. Norwalk, always a great track. So that was pretty cool. Another race I want to touch on was the Midwest Stock Super Stock Series and the Heartland Series. And I don't think this is the first year they've done it, but they did kind of a combo.
Well, they call it the Indy Alternative.
Right.
They've done it now for probably 7, 8, maybe longer than that.
Yep.
I think it pays $4,000 to win each day and $2,000 to runner up. They normally get between 100 and 115 stock super stock cars for it. They're getting a little worried. I talked to some of the guys that helped run that deal, and they're getting a little worried if they get over 128 cars, what they're going to do, because they've been encroaching that, you know, 115, 120. And that's their biggest problem now, because their series is doing so well, is, you know, they don't want to turn people away, but what do we do if we get over that 128 car field? So that's a good problem to have for them, but it's a tough deal on, you know, do you turn people away? Do you make it 128? Then do you go to an all run deal? So they haven't had that issue yet, but I got a feeling it's coming sometime down the road. So.
Yeah, I saw that it looks like this year they had, I saw a couple different posts on Facebook and stuff, and I kind of wrote it down, but looks like they had somewhere around 106 cars.
They were down a little bit this year. They had a couple more guys from Division 5 came to Indy this year. The guy with the front-wheel drive car, you know, Bill Dyer, some of their regulars, you know, selected to go to Indy this year, which they haven't in a while. So.
That
series is a great series. I mean, those guys, they run 10 to 12 races a year, and I think most of them pay $2,000 to win, and I think they've got 4 or 5 of them a year that pay $4,000 to win. And I mean, just the payouts for a $100 entry is really phenomenal when you sit back and look at, you know, what we pay to run these points meets 2-3 days and what those guys pay out over a weekend. I think so. Yeah, I mean, I know Jason DeForest a couple years ago had really good success at one of those things. He either won and run it up or won both of them, and collected almost $8,000, you know, for 2 days worth of work in a stock super stock combo, which I don't even know if you can get $8,000 winning a national event sitting around for 4 or 5 days anymore.
For a week.
Yeah, a week, yeah.
So, yeah, probably not.
So those guys do a real good job up there. I know they've got their division director. They've incorporated a couple of those races with national opens, so you get a grading point, which has helped out tremendously, you know, where you got guys, especially in Division 5, where it's so ridiculously huge. I mean, pretty much everything from Brainerd to Denver to Earlville over to Grand Bank, Kansas. I mean, that division, you know, you can put 15,000 miles on a truck easily in a year in that division trying to chase everything.
Yeah, and I know they also did it, you know, 2 weeks before the Earlville divisional race. It was this past weekend. So I think I heard there was a, you know, number of people that, you know, kind of left their rigs there.
And that track is really stock, super stock, and sportsman friendly. You know, the guys that own that, they race super stock for a while. I think they still have the car. They're real good about letting people leave their rigs there. It's got security all the time. They got that little campground there. It's actually one of my favorite tracks, just because it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. It's got a really decent atmosphere. The weather's normally, you know, it's not super hot. It's not really cold yet. There's cornfields all around it. It's the starting line's down in a bowl. So it's just a neat little place out in the middle of nowhere that I really enjoy going to.
Yeah. Now the other race that happens on Labor Day weekend is the Canadian Stock Super Stock Series. You know, they always have a pretty big race as well. And this day, this Labor Day was, it looks like it was at Toronto Motorsports Park. And from the results I looked like they had, you know, somewhere in the mid 40s of cars. And John Sierra, out of, I think he's out of upstate New York, is victorious over Jim Lindsay. And lone semifinalist was Steve McGrath. So just want to, you know, kind of shout out to the Canadian guys. But, you know, if you look at the, you know, 300-ish stock super stock cars over at Indy, you had 100-plus at the Midwest race, and let's just call it 50 at the Canadian race. You know, you had over 450 stock super stock racers racing really within probably, what's that, about a 10-hour total, like totally east to west.
You're probably in a 10-hour radius circle, but, you know, with Indy being kind of the focal point.
Yeah, I mean, darn near 500 stock super stock cars racing on one weekend. I mean, that's if anybody says stock super stock racing is dead, I'd say that is not an accurate statement. So I thought that was pretty cool. Okay. So I guess, Austin, do you have any stock super stock series down in the Texas area that you guys run, or is it not as much down there? I really don't know of one.
Right. Yeah, we don't really have a local series per se, and they've tried to do a couple of national opens down here before. They just didn't get great participation. It's just, I don't know. I think it's a little bit different for where we live, because there's really not just like a hotbed of stock and super stock racers. I mean, I guess you could have claimed that in the Belrose area back in the day, but I don't know if there's enough people that really want to support it. Cause like I said, they've tried a few things over the years and it just didn't garner great support. Like these other series have taken off recently.
Yeah, I know. We've talked to the Emmonses about this before. I think the biggest problem you got down in Division Four is there's just not the car count. You know, at a point to meet, you guys get 50, 60 stockers and 30, 40 super stockers, where you go to, you know, Division Five or Division Three, you're getting double that amount for a points meet. So it's a little easier to try to put on, you know, a combo race, and you got twice as many cars to pull from.
Right. Yeah. I think it's just kind of like it's kind of a little bit of a numbers game there. So, like I said, it's just a little difficult here, but who knows? I mean, it seems like people are willing to spend more money these days in all forms of racing. So who knows? If you started something, maybe it could kind of take off.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, and I know we talked about this a few weeks ago, but I think you kind of blend into a good time to ask a question to you, Austin. But you've seen these just crazy amount of payouts that have been announced. You know, more on the bracket side, predominantly on the top bulb side. But, I mean, I know next year, in 2020, there are two different races that are going to pay over $1 million to win. I mean, did you ever think there'd be a day that in a sportsman bracket-style drag race would pay $1 million?
No, I mean, I thought the 500s were a little crazy. but, I mean, well, Peter and Kyle and, you know, I guess the original million, right, was the originator of that, right? Peter and Kyle kind of emulated that a little bit with their Vegas fling. And then Kyle Riley kind of took it to a whole nother level. But, you know, I thought the 500 grander I thought was a little bit crazy. And then you see that they had over 700 cars on the property. So they, I think it's just a little bit different. I'm a little bit worried for your local bracket racing, in my opinion. And I think my favorite type of race is like your 5 grander, your 10 grander for low entry.
Yep.
I'd rather pay like $100 and run for $5,000 and not deal with 600 cars myself. But
yeah,
it's just a matter of opinion and preference on which one you want to race. But the $1 million race at Memphis next year, that's decently close to me. It's about 500 miles. So I've got my eye on it, especially since they have that bottom bulb portion as well as the top bulb portion, kind of how Peter and Kyle do their Pro 38 or whatever it is out in Vegas.
Do you think with all these big money bracket races coming into effect now, you know, with Kyle and with Peter, and, you know, you were starting to see some other people pop up. I mean, you know, Tyler B's putting on a couple of them, you know, 100 granders at Ohio Valley. Do you think this will start to hurt, you know, super comp, super gas at the national event level, where guys will just kind of quit going to those and start picking up more of these bracket races? Or do you think that's kind of, you know, outside that realm with those guys? Because it hasn't seemed to affect, from what I've seen on the entry list so far, a whole lot yet.
Yeah, I think it's more of an apples and oranges type thing, really, because, I mean, you go to one of these races, and it's like I said at the 500 in Michigan, you had at least probably 500 racers, or let's say 400, because a bunch of people were doubled. But
right.
You said probably had 400 racers drop at least $5,000. Like, that's not sustainable for multiple events. So, you know, if you plan to go to one race or so, then you can save up and pay that $5,000 or whatever. But, you know, these huge races, like I guess I would call them over the last 3 or 4 years, I really wouldn't say it's hurt anything. I mean, I think the economy is so dang strong right now. And some people are leaving the bracket scene because they don't want to pay $5,000 on a weekend and maybe go run Super Comp and try something different and not run till 2 a.m. And I think it's just a little bit of a preference deal. From what I can tell, divisionals and nationals, the car counts have been strong given this surge of bracket racing. So I think it's all going to come down to preference. I really don't think either of them – I think they can both survive. The problem is one of these promoters is going to take a bad hit here soon, and it may be the end of one promoter or so, but I just don't know when that's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm surprised it hasn't affected the division level more. The national event level, I can see it not hurting. But, you know, when you go, I mean, and we all do it, you know, but if you had a Super Comp or Super Gas card, you could go run for $5,000. You know, for 2 days, like you're talking about, for a low entry, or go to a points meet for 3 or 4 days and race for $1,000 and spend, you know, 3 days there. I just, if I had a dragster, I'm surprised we get as good a car count as we do at these points meets with all these other options around that are better paying and even not even high dollar bracket races, but, you know, $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 that are pretty much everywhere all the time, you know, around us.
I can tell you, though, Charlie, that, you know, Super Comp was in the mid-30s for the Car Rock National event, the Weekday Nationals this last week. And I think some of that was because, you know, Marco Abruzzi and Travis Colangelo at American Race Cars and Jacob Elrod, they put together 320s at Dragway 42 only an hour away. You know, and I know for sure there's definitely some guys that pulled out of Super Comp and Super Gas just to go run that event. But I kind of agree with Austin that, you know, I think there'll be some guys that'll go chase big money for bracket racing for a little bit. There'll be some guys that say, you know what, I don't feel like being up till 3 or 4 in the morning to run 2 rounds at some big dollar bracket race. You know, I want to come and sit in my motorhome and kind of race over a 3-day event at kind of a slower pace. So I think there's some of both. I can tell you at the 525 that Kyle put on at in Michigan this past summer, I watched quite a bit of the live feed. I had a couple friends that went up there and raced. And there was quite a few, you know, former stock superstock guys that were at that event, you know, running bracket races. So, you know, it's definitely changed some things. I think when that kind of money is put up, it's hard, you know, if you feel like a good racer, like kind of like Austin said, he's got his eye on that million. I mean, it's 500 miles away, kind of close. It's tempting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's, everybody wants to win one of those big ones and get life-changing money, obviously, or win the prestige of an NHRA race. I mean, it's just kind of all what you prefer. I'm curious to see next year, since Jared Pennington and his promotion staff scheduled that $100,000 foot brake race Labor Day weekend next year. So I'm curious to see how much that affects Indy. In the end, I don't think it's going to affect it much. I think maybe a handful, maybe.
Where are they having that race at?
It's at Bristol.
Bristol.
Okay.
So they're having the foot break. I mean, it is foot break. It's not bottom bulb. So, I mean, that's a little bit, you know, different in terms of, you know, stock and super stock. A lot of, you got your transfer guys and super stock and your two-step guys and in stock. Or in Charlie's case, he can just use his clutch. So he can run either of them. But, I'm curious to see what it does. I mean, I just don't see that many people because Indy's Indy. So, I mean, that's $100,000 foot race or bottom bulb race, but it's, I don't think it'll have much effect on Indy.
I mean, what do you think has got more prestige, you know, you know, you kind of do a little bit of both, Austin. I mean, you know, Indy or one of them 100 granders. I mean, if you had to pick, you know, if you had one you could win, I mean, what would you pick?
I would probably pick Indy just because, I mean, you're talking about the biggest names in the sport. I mean, you're talking Don Garlitz and Dom Perdome and Bob Glidden and, you know, all those people that have won Indy, you know, 8 or 9 times, and that meant everything to them. And you're talking about a race that's 65 years old. I mean, it's kind of like, even though in terms of bracket racing, right, so you've got the original million in Alabama, I still think, even though if it's not the biggest paying race anymore, I still think everyone wants to win that one the most.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I agree 100% with you, man. I think you're spot on.
All right, cool. Well, you talk about Indy. Let's get to Indy. You know, so I didn't go, but I watched quite a bit on the live feed, Drivery Central, Class Racer, etc. Talked to you a few times, Charlie, and Austin. Obviously, you guys went, but it seems to me like the thing that everybody was talking about, kind of before the race even started, was the parking situation. So why don't you kind of give us the details on that, Charlie?
So parking, I mean, last year they went to this deal where, you know, we're not going to park till Tuesday morning. Everything went good. They had 10 people doing it. The weather was perfect. They were able to lay everything out on Monday, and that was great. Well, this year, you know, Sunday rolls around. You got 200 and 300 rigs ready to go. Monday looks like it's going to rain all day, so you can't lay the stuff out. And in their infinite wisdom, NHRA decided to cut the staff to, like, 4 people. So you've got more rigs than you had last year, especially with Top Sportsman, Top Dragster being there. Yes, you cut out, you know, 40 stock, super stock guys, but you added 80 Top Sportsman, Top Dragster, which take a little bit longer to park because they're on the opposite side. It's a little more congested over there with comp, alcohol. So, you know, you're bouncing back and forth with 4 people. It takes more work. They didn't get stuff laid out in time. They didn't start on time on Tuesday. To the parking people's, you know, I don't blame them one bit for this cluster that showed up, because from what I understand, 3 of the people that were there parking were there on Sunday. They called Josh Peterson and Ned and asked if they could start parking cars because they saw what the weather looked like. They said that no one was to be on the grounds till Monday at 9 o'clock. They weren't paying anybody. So this whole fiasco relies firmly on the shoulders of Josh Peterson and Ned. You know, it's just, there's mismanagement 100%. They got away with it last year because we had perfect weather and less rigs. Total clusterfuck. We had people, their rigs, and they pulled guys into mud holes in the on the pro side at the top. You know, Don Kennedy, you know, he didn't want to go there. He got in an argument with a guy. They pulled him in there anyways. He ended up getting stuck, had to get pulled out. You know, he had just washed his rig before he came there. There was a bunch of guys that had just polished up stuff and had muddy wheels because they pulled him in over here. Then you had you're trying to get those guys out, and they were parking other people that showed up later than people that had already been there, so we almost had a couple fist fights over that. It was just undermanned, poorly laid out in weather. So that was, everybody was kind of on edge. I know at, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, the guys that had showed up, you know, Tuesday afternoon and Wednesday were not parked. They were still in the staging lanes. I think when they called Stock Eliminator up or on standby, there were still 40 or 50 rigs. They parked guys over by the road course. You know, so like if you had a stock or a super stock car, you had to go to the lanes on the opposite side. Then you go to the opposite side of the track to scale. Then drive your car all the way down the return road, through the pro pits, through the back. Just wasn't enjoyable for a lot of those guys that, you know. And there was plenty of parking on the other side. I mean, it was just a mismanaged deal from upper management is all that was. So that's my 2 cents on the parking.
Yeah, one of the funny things I saw, or I would say funny, I don't know, interesting things I saw on social media, Dan Fletcher posted a thing and he said, you know, he was complaining about the parking situation. And, you know, he said he had to do some work on the car, you know, before Q1. So he actually left the track, went to found some parking lot, some Walmart or something, unloaded his cars and worked on them for a couple hours before going and getting back in line.
Yeah, Dan showed up Tuesday. I want to say it was around noon. They'd only parked about 50 rigs at that time out of the 500 or so that were in line. And he's like, I got shit to do. He wheeled in, wheeled out, did all his work stuff, and then came back. So he was, you know, not impressed with the operation.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, there were some things that were out of their control with the rain and the weather. But at the same time, you know, they had to see this coming. Like, it's not like, you know, the 525 at Michigan that we were talking about earlier. They didn't know how many cars were going to come. Like,
yeah,
they knew there's going to be 800 cars coming. So,
I mean, you know, they're so worried about saving a few pennies. I mean, I talked to a couple of guys, and, you know, a lot of the staff there is making minimum wage. I think $7.71 is what one of the guys told me he was making there. You know, and it's really ridiculous when you look at the amount of money that, you know, sportsmen, pros, that race draws. I mean, this whole fiasco could have been avoided with less than $2,000 with a man help in starting the day earlier. I mean, you take an event like Indy that brings in millions of dollars. It's an NHRA-owned facility, you know, and we're skimping on parking people and not letting guys park a day early. It's in the total scope of reality, it's ridiculous that is what, you know, slowed the U.S. Nationals down right from the start. And, you know, Stocker guys, you know, Austin, myself, you know, we lost one of the runs, you know, because of their mismanagement. You know, Super Comp, Super Gas lost a run. So it really put a bad taste in everybody's mouth because the top management couldn't, you know, fix this problem that was fixable. Now you got people that are paying, you know, $400 plus crew guys to come race, and, you know, it means a lot to everybody, and now everybody's getting cheated out of runs. So it really left a bad taste in mine, along with everybody else that was there. And we'll all get over it. I mean, 300 and some days, you know, everybody will be entered, and most of them will come back again. But, you know, still, it's when you can fix these problems and they're not major issues, it's just ridiculous that it can't be handled.
You have a similar experience, Austin?
Yeah, so I came in around 2:00 in the afternoon on Tuesday, and I was number 470. And so I think I finally got parked about 1:30 on Wednesday, 1:30 in the afternoon, and then, you know, I think we started right at 2:00. So, I mean, I didn't have much time at all. To NHRA's credit, I'll give them a tiny bit, is they did allow you to get your tech cards early. You couldn't get, like, your packet with your pit vehicle sticker and all that stuff. But you could get tech cards early, and you were able to fill those out and go turn those into the credential trailer, or in the case of Stock and Super Stock, go get your tech card verified to Travis about your weight and all of that stuff. And so luckily, once, you know, I did that early, thankfully, but I think I had about 30 minutes, so I didn't even mess with my dragster on the top of the lift. I just unloaded the Camaro and hauled butt to scales real quick, and just to make sure, and then start chilling it down, because you don't know, it's first qualifier, might as well try and go fast, but now you're running in the afternoon, so, I mean, it was just all kind of a mess, because the first qualifier Wednesday was a solid probably 10th slower than the next morning. So it was kind of moving the qualifying, and people that are kind of on the edge, it was probably kind of messing with them a little bit. But like Charlie said, the biggest complaint I heard was people are paying $380 and only got, or, you know, got down a run. And so I think that was the biggest complaint. And of course, after 3 or 4 days, you know, you kind of forget about it, but it was not a good start, and I guess I just don't really understand the thought process, because there was probably 150 rigs on the pro side down on the road course area. I would probably say 150. I don't know exactly, but I don't know what they were thinking, if they could get them all on the sportsman side, because it was decently full on the sportsman side. So, like, I guess I just don't understand the decision, or where they thought everyone was going to park.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do for next year, if they, you know, reduce the car counts a little bit, or, you know, maybe they'll just, you know, change the schedule a little bit, but hopefully they learn from their mistake and get it figured out.
Yeah, the best thing they could do is do like, I think Norwalk has two time split booths, right? One on each side of the track?
Yes, they do.
Okay, so if they're going to pit some sportsmen on that side, probably need to do top sportsmen and top dragster. And I only say that because those cars rarely, and I mean rarely, get anywhere close to the minimum weight. So, I mean, I know that the scales are on one side of the track, but if you just weighed them one run and say, you know what, you're good for the weekend, if they're going to continue to have top dragster and top sportsmen, then let them turn off of the track to the right and just put another time split booth over there. It's not hard. If they're going to continue to want 900 cars at the U.S. Nationals.
Yeah, that would definitely help even at, like, the points meets and stuff.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. The problem is you got to go through that road course. It's kind of a long jaunt, you know, because it's not laid out real well over there. As far as back over to the pits.
Yeah.
So, the one thing I will give NHRA credit for is, you know, they've in the past at Indy, they've always been notorious, you know, for jacking everybody around till 9, 10 o'clock at night and then getting everybody back at 7 in the morning. This year, you know, we had some weather, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you know. They did a good job of letting guys know early in the day, you know, especially with stock and some of the super classes, you know, that they were going to cancel the night sessions and you know, let us know with a lot of time. Because that's a lot of people's gripe is, you know, we ran around all day to run. You know, we got canceled there Saturday morning, I think it was. Or no, was it Saturday? Yeah, Saturday morning we got canceled out because of rain. Then they said they were going to run us between the pros. And then they made the decision about 4 or 5 to run us the next morning on Sunday. I will give them credit on that deal because they let everybody know early in the day they were going to cancel the stuff. They did a good job communicating, you know, with that new pager system that they've had the last couple of years and keeping everybody informed of, you know, schedules and that in a timely manner and not stringing people out till, you know, 7, 8, 9 at night and then saying, oh, well, we're not going to run you like in years past. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they caught a lot of bad luck because I want to say they had like 3 oil downs within 3 pairs and alcohol dragster one day. We had the Pro Mod wreck the one night. I mean, they had a lot of issues on the track unrelated to weather. But some of that you can't help. And it is what it is. But it's like Charlie said, they let us know at 4 or 5 in the afternoon at the latest that we would be canceled for the day and, you know, and then come back at 7:30 in the morning or 7:45 or whatever it was.
Now, one other issue I saw quite a bit of scuttlebutt about on, you know, Stock Superstock, or I mean on social media, you know, about Indy, was they had some timing issues. I know there was a rerun in Supergas. I know there were some top dragster runs thrown out. Then there were some other runs that looked suspect, but they didn't throw out. I mean, it seemed a little unprecedented for them to do some reruns. What did you guys see at the track?
It seemed like the right lane had some issues all weekend. I talked to one superstock guy on the second hit, and he knows what his car runs. I'm not going to name his name. And his car was set up to go, you know, 91 or 92 under. And he made a pass and was like, you know, mid second and a half under, or not second and a half, but 105. And he's looking at his slip, he's looking at his 60 foot times, you know, his 330, 660. And he comes over to me and we're talking. He goes, look at this. He goes, my first run, I'm a tenth and a half quicker. And he said, I haven't done anything to this car. He said, this car will not go that fast here. And I saw that out of another person in Superstock. I think it was the second session also in the right lane. So there was some mechanical gremlins there. I didn't know they ran. I think it was LaBoost they reran because his times, nothing computed to what it would run compared to other times. You know, he made a case for it. But there was definitely some issues, you know, with people giving bogus 60-foot times, bogus, you know, 1,000-foot. It wasn't every run, though, so that's what I don't understand. Austin, did you see anything or hear anything?
I mean, I was, of course, I run Super Comp as well, so I get to see that side of some rounds as well. So in Super Gas, there was 2 reruns. One was Denny Napier and John LaBoost.
And the other pair was Allison Prose, and I think his name was Tom McClain. It was a purple 63 Corvette Roadster. But, you know, I guess Allison and John, you know, they were later on the tree, like 60, 70, 80 on the tree. Maybe I don't remember the numbers. And then way fast down track. I don't know if you call that like a hanging beam or what you call it, but the other run that I think hung up, there was one in Top Fuel, second or third round, whichever one Mike Salinas lost. I think a normal 60-foot on Top Fuel drag was like 820, 830, and he was like 150 on the tree and 760 to 60-foot. But in a heads-up class, right, like it doesn't really matter, right, in like Top Fuel.
Right.
But in a like a 998-90 top dragster bracket race setting, it can affect a lot. The other run that I think was bogus was Jason Lyons 10 flat, because he was one something on the tree, I want to say. It was like 123 to 60 foot. None of the numbers added up going down track. And I don't know if you remember, but he come back around. They did switch carburetors in between qualifiers, which I have another deal on that in a second, but he comes back around after going 10 flat. The air is better in the second session on Wednesday, and he goes 10.08. And so I thought that was a little funny, and then I got to looking at it, and all of his numbers were slow all the way down. And, I mean, Jason Lyon can work some miracles, but a 123 60-foot in that big old Buick is kind of unheard of. So where I get to with that is he qualified, what, number, I don't know, top 10? And so that really could have had a kind of a butterfly or wave effect going down in terms of the ladder. And, yeah, he was a top 10 qualifier. So, you know, if he's number 9 instead, or number, let's say, 20 instead of number 9, right, or whatever, that's going to have an effect all the way through the ladder. So I think it's a real shame that we have an NHRA-owned facility at the biggest race of the year and have – timing issues all the way, right? So Jason's run was on Wednesday. The Labuse run was Friday, and they actually had to rerun them Saturday. And then we know we had issues Monday with the top dragster video. So I think it's kind of a shame that they couldn't really pinpoint and find out what it was, especially with Brockmeyer being at the facility the whole weekend.
And I believe they did not rerun the top dragster, right?
No, and of the ones, in my opinion, I thought that one deserved a rerun, and then I could make the case that the other ones didn't. I know somebody put it that what they're saying in the previous run is that their timing system had a malfunction, and then on the later run, it was, our timing system's correct, something's wrong with your car. They're sending out, like, kind of a bad message there, and I actually feel bad for Afton Swanson there. I kind of thought she got a raw deal, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's kind of unprecedented for NHRA to kind of do any reruns. So I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, but like, if you're going to do reruns, then I think you kind of got to do reruns for everybody that looks suspect. Now I do, you know, Denny Napier and John Labuse. You know, obviously John Labuse is a great racer, one of the best out there. And you know, I think when he goes to the tower and says, "Look, I wasn't 60, and if I was 60, I didn't go 84," you know, whatever the circumstances were, I think unfortunately they probably give more credit to someone like that when they come to the tower. And I don't know, it's just a shame if there were some other runs that maybe should have been rerun that weren't. And hopefully they can get it, you know, fixed for the future, because I raced IHRA for a long time, and there were some tracks that we would go to that would have like TSI timing systems, which I don't know if you ever ran on that, Austin. But they had a lot of problems back in the day. And it just wasn't consistent. And you knew that if you raced a lot of those tracks that had TSI, you would get some runs that just didn't make sense. And you would just have to pick up that time slip and throw it away and forget about it, because you just couldn't explain it. They couldn't explain it. And it just caused, you know, a lot of it changed a lot of outcomes of races that I'd seen over the past. You know, some good for me, some bad. And, you know, I think, you know, as much money as we spend and as much money goes into this sport, obviously, to have, you know, timing issues is just, it's frustrating, right? It's probably one of the worst things that can happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so that's the bad. Now let's talk about the good at Indy. we had talked about last week or so about qualifying, and it looks like in Superstock the bump ended up being 79 some change, which I think was a little steeper than what we had talked about, right, Charlie? That was a little bit better than it has been the past few years.
Yeah, it was a little better. I forgot that they gave the Hemi guys, you know, that giant gift, you know, of 2 or 3 tenths. That index used to be 930, and, you know, when guys used to actually run that class fast, like Westcott and them guys, and they'd beat on it all the time, you know, it kept getting lower and lower. Well, you know, Charlie and a few of those guys, they haven't raced it in a while, and, you know, everybody's been crying, you know, because they can only go 52 under, you know, 45 under. So NHRA put it back to, I believe, 970 or 960.
Yep.
I can't remember what it is.
I think it is 970 now. I think they give them like 4 tenths.
Yeah, so, I mean, I forgot about that because you had all the Hemis down at the bottom. And now, you know, guys that were 52 under are 82 under. So, or 92 under. I mean, yeah, I saw the other day Rick Johnson was, you know, almost a second under. And I'm like, Rick Johnson hasn't been a second under, in, you know, ever. And I started looking at it, and I'm like, oh, that's right. They gave these guys that gift. So, you know, you had 15 cars there that brought it up, you know, probably, a solid dime from where it was. And, the crazy part is all those guys pissed and bitched and moaned, you know, the index is too hard. And then come first round, 15 of them are gone. You know, we ended up having, what, 3 buy runs first round of Superstock after all that?
Yeah, I was going to say, there was 158 people that qualified at Indy in Superstock, and I know there were 3 buy runs. So that means that, you know, roughly, I mean, there was, you know, everybody that went got to race if they wanted to. If they went down there, you know, I guess it was Monday morning, right, and waited to see if they'd get a run. So I thought that was, you know, pretty interesting, and I think some of the reason for that obviously was, you know, not running all the way until Monday. I think that probably, you know, some guys that I saw on social media and some other forums that, you know, some guys had to be back for work and that sort of thing, and they just got frustrated and left.
There's a lot of Superstock guys that still, you know, class is the main priority. You know, class was done on Friday. You know, if they didn't tear down, they sat around Saturday. You know, Sunday, you know, it looked like it was going to be a giant CF, you know, with Stock Eliminator not getting to run on Saturday and then trying to run 4 rounds there. And I know a couple guys, you know, they got there Sunday morning and they just said, you know, I'm stepping my car down. I don't feel like running second round at, you know, 10 o'clock at night like we have in years past. Then getting up Monday morning, coming back, you know, I'm not going to put myself through torture. I'm already mad because of the parking deal. And you know, 4 or 5 of those guys went home because of that. They had been indied out, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Now in Stock Eliminator, I think it was more traditional, kind of a traditional bump spot, like we've seen in years past. It was 88-1 before the couple guys got thrown out.
I think it ended up being like 87-1 or 87-2. I know Bossinger got in, Brian Rogers. And I can't remember who the last person to get in. But then they ended up taking, I think, 4 or 5 alternates. I know Jason McCormick got in. Gary Hershey, I think, was the last car to get in at, like, 84 with a 1. So if you could run 85 under, you know, you got the play on, you know, out of the 128.
Yeah, so a little slower than years past.
Yeah, and, you know, everybody talked about the air being pretty good there, and that was kind of an optical illusion, I would say. You know, they kept saying, oh, it's only going to be 80, you know, it's going to be 70s in the morning. I went back through the logbooks, and it was a touch better, but, you know, what we gained in temperature, you know, decrease, you know, we lost in barometer. So it really, it was a little bad, felt a little better than years past, but really it wasn't hardly any faster.
Yeah, I think I actually ran the numbers before I went because I'm a numbers guy and I sit at a desk and I don't work sometimes. But I ran the number on the last 5 years, and it had been between 87.1 and 89.3 under the last 5 years. And which is kind of remarkable when you think about it, that you've got 5 years of data and it's within a couple hundredths. But I think you're right. I think it was 4 or 5 alternates. And I do believe I heard that number 96, I think it was the first non-second under car. Was like number 96, maybe 99. I can't remember, but I think it was number 96.
Yeah, Drew Whalen was number 96, and he went 99.9 under.
Right, yeah, that's pretty. You had 95 cars at a second under. Plus, actually,
yeah.
If you really want to call, the other three went a second under as well. That, well, I guess two of the three that got DQ'd were a second under as well.
let's talk about, just let's briefly touch on teardown. They tore down, what, 12 cars, Charlie?
Yeah, it was a 6 and 6 in stock, and super stock. I think it was like 6 and 5. Bobby Brandon got the boot. You know, his was kind of, it was a little petty. You know, he had a couple pistons. You know, all the pistons were nicked just barely, but it was all, there wasn't a clean piston. And the way the rules bend is you got to have at least one piston that's clean. It was just barely nixing all of them. No performance. You could see on the valve where it had been hit. But, you know, in that instance, the rule is the rule. I mean, the way it was explained to me is, you know, when you go on the shelf from CP or Diamond, whoever, you buy that piston, you know, does it have that nick in it? Nope. Well, then it's not as produced. So.
Right. Yeah. The term I was told was that, I guess in the rule book, it's modified pistons. It's just like Charlie said. Is that piston does not come from like a piston manufacturer, for instance, like that. So that's why it was tossed. But I also heard, I don't know how true this is, but from the person I heard it from, I think it's true, is that they told him if he turned the pistons around, they'd let him run. But I don't know 100% if that was true or not.
I guess it would depend on the piston. If it was a flat top piston or if it's a dish, and some of those pistons have got reliefs only on one way, like a 396,
right.
375 horse, you know, you can't turn that around. I can't believe that they let that go, but it's possible. You know, I couldn't tell you on that. Bobby got tossed, which made Jason Lyon the winner. Gary Summers got tossed because he had it. The head was in the book, supposedly, but they took it out. It wasn't an approved casting number, supposedly. He argued with them that it was, and it wasn't, but it wasn't in their book. So that's what they had to go by. So he got the boot there for, you know, a head. Supposedly, they had that car down 2 or 3 times with that head that had gone through. So not this time. And then Doug Gibson in Fenner's car. Rumor on that was it was about 35 grams light on the rod piston combo. And that, you know, everybody kind of was bitching because that car qualified, you know, 126 out of 128. And there was another car that qualified, I think, 120. And everybody was kind of like, well, why'd you take the cars that are, you know, barely got in? And, you know, it was told to me that, you know, nobody was safe. So I think that's good. You know, it kind of throws up anybody that's thinking about doing this stuff. It just shows that, you know, nobody's off limits. It doesn't matter if you're number 126 or number 4. You know, it's a random deal. You know, I know the guys with the Cobra Jet, you know, they were mad because they were there last year. But as it was explained, you know, they brought a different engine this year, a different combination. You know, they were kind of crying that they got tore down and they said, that's great, but that's not the engine that you had in the car when you came this time. You know, you claim a 13, not a 14. So, you know, those guys were kind of pissing and moaning about that. But, you know, that's part of the deal. You go to Indy, you never know. I mean, I've gotten popped 2 years in a row, and then I've gotten away for 3-4 years without getting it. So it just depends. You know, they did do carburetor and throttle body on every class winner, which I thought was a good deal. After Q1, you know, they sealed up everybody's carb, and if you wanted to change a carburetor, you had to come get them, and they had to come over. take the carb off the car that you ran, put the one on, reseal it back up. And I think they checked the carb that you took off on the spot. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was kind of the rumor I heard from one of the guys that was doing carbs, because there was a couple people that changed it during the event, you know, and they went over and, you know, double checked to make sure the carbs they pulled off, you know, was actually legit, and then they put another carb on and resealed the car up again. So I thought that was a real good deal.
Yeah, I think that is true, because I kind of alluded to that earlier with Jason Lyons when he changed carburetors in between qualifiers. NHRA did go over there and checked it and, you know, resealed it after he put the new carburetor on and made that second qualifier. But I thought it was – I don't know about you, Charlie, but I thought Wesley had kind of a spring in his step there because he's the one – I think he did all of stock eliminator as far as the sealing and – and I don't think he got too in-depth on the teardown as far as, like, checking all of the stuff, but I think he was kind of overseeing it all. And from what I had a couple conversations with Wesley that was really good, and I think he's optimistic about the stock, super stock, getting us kind of back in line, I guess, as everybody else said it.
Yeah, and I would agree to that 100%. You know, Wesley's been off the scene now for, I would say, 7, 8, 10 years, somewhere in there. You know, I know when Jeff Connolly took over that position here in the last year, he put together what so far looks to be a pretty good team from what I can see. You know, we got Travis coming back to a lot more national events than he's ran. You know, Wesley's back. I mean, these are numbers guys, and there's a lot of knowledge between all these guys. You know, they've been doing this, some of them over 30 years, some of them over 40. I mean, there's, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? There's no, the knowledge that those guys have, you know, you can't teach somebody in 5 years. I mean, it's just years and years and years of doing it and doing it and doing it. So, yeah, I mean, I was really happy. I mean, I've been a big proponent of checking carburetors and throttle bodies, especially on second under runs, because there's been a lot of shenanigans the last couple of years, you know, with guys putting big throttle bodies on, big carburetors, you know, and no one checking them, especially at heads-ups, you know, at the divisional level. You know, I know Don Luca in Division 4 has tore down a couple of random people at points meets. So it looks like tech is back to stay for now. You know, those guys have always been fair. I mean, there's probably nobody in the sport that's more fair than, you know, Travis and Wesley. You know, what's right is right and wrong is wrong. I mean, that's the way those guys have been for years. And, you know, there's no real gray area.
Right, yeah. My favorite Wesley response of any question I've ever asked him is that he always says, well, what does the rule book say? And that's the first thing he'll respond with every single time. And he'll look at the rule book, and then he'll interpret it if you need it interpreted. But, yeah, it's like Charlie said, there's no gray area, and they're trying to get it back in line. And as far as checking stuff, I mean, you've got Division 5 caught two people with incorrect intakes just by checking the carburetor, right? So they yep. pulled four random cars after a qualifying run. They got one in Topeka and one in Brainerd, Minnesota. Just by checking carb and intake numbers and, you know, wheelbase and, you know, just a, I guess we're going to call that a mini teardown. I don't really know what we want to call that, but, you know, just by doing that, they got two people that weren't in line there. So, I mean,
yeah, I mean,
and that didn't take a lot of effort.
Correct. You know, I think these spot checks are going to be more of a, you're going to see more and more of them. They're pretty easy to do. You know, you can pull over four or five people at a time and, you know, rip off a couple throttle bodies, a couple carburetors, you know, check them and send people on the way. So, yeah, I was real happy. The one thing in teardown that I was a little confused on was the Lincoln Morehead deal. You know, Lincoln blew up his motor, but he couldn't officially finish teardown because they couldn't bore and stroke the car because he'd broke a rod, I guess. So he wasn't allowed to change motors, and he wasn't racing, and he didn't get thrown out. So, I don't know if they gave him a free pass on that or what the whole deal is, but there was a couple guys who were a little, you know, they were a little, what's the word I'm looking for? Just
like perturbed?
Yeah, perturbed, yeah. because, you know, and I didn't really think about it because I said, what's the difference? Everybody's going to get to race because all these guys went home. And they said, well, that's great, you know, but if you're number 130 or 129 and, you know, Lincoln didn't pass. Now, not that Lincoln's car wouldn't have passed because it passed the cylinder head, it passed the intake. It was just Born Stroke. You know, odds of that car with being Gulius not passing a Born Stroke, slim to none.
Right.
The other aspects of it, you know, may be questionable. But they said, you know, the problem is if you're number 129, you don't get any points. You know,
correct.
If you win the race and you're 129, you don't get any points. So, you know, the guy that's 129, he's bitching because he says, well, listen, yeah, that's great, but he didn't, you know, you said it yourself. You know, you guys picked him for a teardown. He didn't pass. Now, I remember a couple years ago kind of the same situation with, I can't remember if it was Ernie Neal or somebody, maybe it was David, or they had a cylinder head that the epoxy had came out of on one of the heads. You know, you could tell that it was the epoxy had just come loose and, you know, it had broke off in there in the you know, the chamber didn't measure in that cylinder, but the rest of them measured fine. You know, and he got the boot, you know. So it's like you do this guy a solid, you know, by not enforcing these rules. But then on the other hand, you know, this guy who, you know, same type of scenario, just bad luck, you know, everything else checks out okay except for that one, because you can clearly see it's broken there. It's not been massaged or anything. It's just a, you know, chunk of epoxy that's, you know, come off in jagged pieces. You know, they gave him the boot. So I do see both sides on that.
Yeah, I don't, I didn't know about the Born Stroke deal. I just know when I touched base with Leslie about it, because I asked him, because actually Lincoln tore down on Friday. Didn't do the traditional Saturday teardown for Superstock. He did it Friday, because I kind of asked Leslie about it. I was like, well, I was told that, you know, he blew the motor up and they were going home, so might as well check it and, you know, kind of save a day, I guess. And
yep.
The only response Leslie had was he blew it up good, too, is what what Leslie said. I guess he mangled it pretty good.
Yeah. So.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the key classes we kind of went over last week, Charlie. One of them was obviously Superstock J Automatic, and Lincoln won that back-to-back. It looks like the field did get a little tighter. You know, Tyler B. with Jeff Taylor Power definitely caught up and was a little closer than they had been, some of the other guys. But Lincoln still, you know, class of that field by a decent margin. Superstock A Hemi, looks like Jimmy Daniels won again. I think that's, what, 4 or 5 years in a row?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds impressive, and I'm not taking anything away from Jimmy, but, you know, that class is really – there's three players in that class anymore. There's 20 cars or 15 cars showed up. You know, I'm way more impressed with Camilla doing it with a stick. You know, if Jimmy Daniels goes out and wins two or three of these with a stick in his car, he'll impress me. That car shifts itself. He lets go of a trans brake and he hangs on 10 and 2 and drives it through. I mean, nothing against the kid. You could probably put a robot in that car. I mean, Barton built a great car. It's a good car. But him, Walkowitz, and Camilla, that's it. You know, Walkowitz's car, you know, it had some issues. It went out early. You know, Camilla had just dumb luck, you know, shift light and this. I mean, you know, he's over there, you know, banging out basically this comp eliminator clutch with an equalizer. You know, I'm way more impressed with that car than Jimmy's car, because just the amount of work and labor and, you know, I personally say make all those guys put sticks in them, you know, and then let's see who comes out on top.
Yeah, I think, didn't Westcott run a stick in his for forever?
Oh, yeah. You know, Charlie ran a stick in his, and, I mean, he ran last round everybody, and he got bored with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I will say this. You know, even back when Charlie was running it, you know, he didn't win it every year. You know, his dad won it once. He had some mechanical problems, I think, 1 or 2 years. I agree with what you said, but to win it that many years in a row and not have any problems – and just make runs, that's tough.
Go back and look at that time period, though. Everybody, there was 6 or 7 cars within a nickel of each other.
That's true, absolutely.
You know, David was there, Charlie, his dad, you know, Wolfowitz,
Hauser, and DeFrank on the West Coast.
Correct. I mean, you know, you had Harry Holton's crew that used to come out here. It was way more competitive 6-7 years. And I was looking at that deal they had in the dragster. I mean, between Westcott and his dad, I think they won it like 6 years in a row there before they quit going.
Oh, yeah.
I think Charlie,
no question. Westcott, you know, was class of the field when he did it. But, you know, it's definitely not what it used to be. That's for sure.
Correct. I mean, and nothing against those guys. I mean, that car is kick-ass. They spend a lot of money on it. But there's only, you know, and nothing against the rest of the guys. I mean, but you look at the ETs, I mean, there's guys that are, most of the guys are 15 numbers behind. I mean, it's not like he was out there cutting 15 lights every time or 20. I think what was his best light in the deal? The 60?
Yeah, he definitely didn't get a lot of good races, that's for sure.
You know, that's what I mean. I mean, it's kind of like when I drove that FSC car that had everybody covered by 3/10. I mean, I had to be 120 on the tree, you know, or better, you know, to not screw up and win. You know, so it's not as, I don't know, it's just not as competitive, I don't think. I mean, and you can look at it, I mean, look at the reaction times. That's all I'm going to say. You know, nothing against the car, nothing against the driver. It's just not as competitive as it once was.
Yeah, for sure. The one other class that I wanted to touch on that I followed pretty closely was the A-Stick Challenge. It's something that we talked about, but you know, Caleb McFarland's more or less kind of had this in the bag for the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. He did lose. He has had some issues, and Joe Martin stuck in there and won it once. But more or less, he's been the class of the field for quite some time. And Michael Manns jumped in there from Minnesota, took a really good A-stock automatic car in 2018, put a stick in it. And from what I read and what I heard, you know, and I helped him a little bit, you know, answered some questions, you know, because I used to have a stick in my Firebird. But, man, he worked his tail off for the past, just give it 8 or 9 months or whenever he started this project. And, you know, when he pulled into Indy, he was not near fast enough to win it.
No.
But he worked on his car every round and worked his butt off. And, you know, he got it figured out. And, he got faster every round when the air was not getting better, and ended winning A-Stick over Caleb in the final. Had a really good race, and I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, once again, it's going to have the same problem the Hemi guys have got, because you've got a combination that fits in there that just outruns everybody else by 15 numbers. You know, I talked to Tom and Gary, talked to Joe Martins, you know, talked to Jason McCormick, and Jason McCormick says, listen, I got a car that went, you know, 10-10, 10-0s, you know, and I'm beating my head up against the wall against these guys who are going 980s because, you know, they're rated, what, 340 or something in a stick when an automatic's rated, you know, 385?
Right. Well, I can tell you that there is a
The problem will be solved before Indy. I can tell you that right now because I know exactly what you're talking about. I would be really surprised if that car doesn't get that combination doesn't get 3.25 by the time April 1st rolls around.
Yeah, I talked to some guys that are working on something, and if it comes through, they're going to put a very, very good LS1. In a stick car and take it south in the spring. And their full goal is to make the 69 Camaro competitive. So,
correct. And that's, you know, that's one of the things, you know, they've been trying to get me to convert my 69, you know, 396, 375 over the stick. And I said, you know, I don't really feel like spending 15 grand to convert a car, you know, plus work a little bit on an engine to go out there and get my ass kicked by, you know, 0.2. So,
yeah, for sure.
And I think it'd be really fun if you get those Firebirds in line, you know, in some of that stuff to where they can go 999, you know, and you get some of these big block Camaros. You know, I know Joe Martin's car ran good. He ran what, 997, I think he ran.
Yep.
You know, and he's got a really good bullet from Kielberg. You know, Denny Ford's got some good stuff out of Division 5. I think he went 10-0s or 999.
I think Lines did his motor, right?
Yep, I know Lance has been working with him and a couple other guys. So, you know, if you get that, if that thing gets, you know, let's just call it 3 1/4 at, you know, 340, that's what, 13 horsepower? That's 130 pounds, 120 pounds. You take a car that's 880s, that's going to put it right in the ballpark with everybody else. Now you've got a driver's race, you know.
Yep.
So, you know, I mean, Brett McFarland, you know, he's got a car that's capable of going 990s, you know, with that 67 car of his. You know, I know Alan Messer, those guys from Division 5, he's got a pretty good running A stick car. And, you know, you might entice guys like that to come out of the woodwork now, you know, Dirk Olson. You know, some of those guys have got some good running cars that now if they think they got a chance, you know, you could get, you know, 13, 15 cars to show up for A stick and have a really cool little battle.
Yeah, for sure. So I guess we'll see how that plays out.
The only thing I was going to add on that is Randy Manns, which he was my pick going into it just because I'm familiar with him running Division 5s quite a bit. I told him in the lane Saturday, Sunday, I don't know what day it was, I said, you were disappointing me until the final, you know, because I thought he would run better. And
right.
I don't know if you saw it, but it did click off technically 140-mile-an-hour run in the final, which I think it was bogus. I think the front end, you know, something
yeah.
got it.
Yep.
But it was going every bit of 138.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. He finally, I mean, I know Brad's helped him, and, you know, we've gone over and helped him, you know, over in Brainerd and stuff, looked at the graph and tried to point him in the right direction. And it hasn't been for a lack of throwing money or working. I mean, there's not a guy, him and his son, that have worked worked harder on a combination than those two over the past 6-7 months.
Yeah, I was told they made some pretty big suspension changes before the final, and the car finally really worked. So,
yeah.
All right, so let's get on to what we've all been waiting for. We got Austin Williams on the podcast, and man, you won stock at Indy. How sweet is that? And not only did you win stock, you did it by winning 2 heads up battles in the semis and in the finals. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts because I guess, you know, I was rolling into Indy. Of course, I took a car that I drove the Camaro that I was driving. I drove it 10 years ago in like 2009, 2010 for Butch Marlowe.
Mm-hmm.
And then when his grandson Thomas was turning 16, he ended up buying the Duster, and then I've kind of been in the Duster ever since. And it's kind of been taken over by our family now, you know, in the last couple of years. But, you know, I took that car, and I was debating on whether to run G or H, and ended up just sticking with H because I've got too much weight on me nowadays. But you know, it's pretty crazy. I mean, the only reason I didn't want to run H or G instead, it's just because amount of cars, right? I mean, there just wasn't
right.
as many cars in G as there was H. But I ended up staying in H, and luckily the ladder played out in a decent way. I mean, you can't really do much when 3 of the 4 cars in the semis are H cars. I mean,
right.
I've held off as long as I can. And luckily we had enough horsepower, I guess, in the final 2 rounds to get the win, but it was a crazy, crazy ending last couple hours to a long week.
Now I'm gonna be honest, I was rooting against you in the final. and purely because on the podcast a few weeks ago, I made Matt Introbius my pick to win Indy.
You did.
And man, you know, I was watching it on my phone, you know, Monday night, refreshing Drag Race Central, and I'm like, man, I got a shot at this. And I really thought Matt probably had you covered performance-wise. And he'd been driving great. I mean, he'd been 10 or 20 quite a bit. He did miss a little bit there in the quarters. But I thought, man, I think I got this. I'm going to give Charlie and Paul Wong a bunch of crap as soon as he wins this. But I was off by 1, and, you know, I was glad to see a good race. And you know, I don't know you very well often, but, you know, awesome job. But I did have to kind of own up to that. I was rooting against you. So sorry about that.
Yeah, that's no problem. I've known Matt, I guess, a couple of years because racing, I guess, Chicago area. And I guess really where I saw him was like the Bowling Green Sport. The first couple of years I went up there and I kind of chatted with him up there. But it's funny because he approached me in the lanes. I want to say it was first or second round of the race, right? Not of class, mm-hmm. but of the stock race. And he was like, he told me, he was like, I figured you'd be a player in H because we've run into him with that car with Thomas driving it at a Bowling Green mm-hmm. before, and they were okay. really close. And, you know, that Thursday run, Thursday class round one, in the same round when I was hopped up a pretty good amount, I went 11.07 and he went 10.95. I mean, that's 1,200. And so I didn't have a ton of hope going into the final, admittedly.
yeah.
I probably had it at about 25-30% chance, just because I had thrown everything at it at that point. And I was like, well, if I can get within 6 or 7, then maybe steal some up front, or maybe he doesn't make a good run, or what have you. And luckily for me, that worked out. Maybe the right lane held the photos or the beam held. Maybe it held in the final. Who knows? But anyway, it was pretty nuts.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I did talk to Matt a week after Indy, and I know that I think he said that his the brake pressure he didn't quite have enough pressure on. The two step came off for just a second. You know, when the tree was coming down or earlier stage, and at some point it kind of threw him off. But he was like, man, Austin made a great run. You know, it had to been, you know, I think what he said, 15 to beat him or whatever the math ended up being. And, you know, he wasn't real sour about it. I thought, you know, I think he figured he made a pretty good run. And, you know, you just made a better one. So, for sure, a great race.
Yeah, it's like I told somebody, I said, you know, we're both coasting in the shutdown because we shut the motors off because they're about to blow up probably.
Right.
And we're coasting, and we stopped just as you turn off the track, and both of us got out of the car, shook hands, you know, chatted, and super professional, super class act about it. And I couldn't have raced a better person in the final, I don't think.
All right, Austin. So one question I did want to ask, how many quarts of oil did you have in the motor in the final?
It probably had just a little bit over 3. I know we've kind of exaggerated that we drained a whole bunch of oil out of it, but I ran, you know, at home I changed and put the lightweight oil in it at home.
Yep.
Before mm-hmm. going up there just for qualifying. And I don't, like I said, I don't know exactly how much it is, but basically all I did for the final is we pulled the oil filter off full and put a fresh oil filter on it. So whatever that holds, you know, half a quart to 3/4 of a quart or whatever that is.
Right.
That's exactly how much we had drained out of it. And that was my plan, right? So when I left here, I said, there's 4 quarts of oil in it. If I get in a situation, we can just pull the oil filter off, put another one on. It's a quick change,
yep.
you know, without having to actually change the oil. And so that was the game plan. And luckily, you know, I guess planning ahead, kind of helped out in that.
Yeah, no, I think that's smart. And I think, you know, I've been in a situation where you're like in full bracket mode and then you got to try to get heads up mode and, you know, you dump the thin stuff in. And sometimes I think it really doesn't help as much as you think because, you know, you hadn't been run. It's right out of the, it's not warm. It's, you know, and yeah, you put 4 quarts of zero weight in, but I really think you're better off to kind of do what you did. Start with light oil and then just take some out and do it in a way you can easily measure it.
Yeah, absolutely. I always think that stuff's a little bit better after a couple runs anyway, kind of like you said. Yeah, that's what that also, I think, contributed to Matt. I'd say he made a good run in the final. I think he had a little bit more in it if he'd have had a little bit more time and stuff. But, you know, in the time that we had, he changed tires and oil and ice down and all that. But I kind of had come off of another heads up, so I was pretty much ready. And when I got back to the trailer, it was it was doing the oil filter, you know, getting the oil out of it, and then just chilling as quick as we could. So I had a little bit of an advantage there in regards to going to the final.
Looking at the final real quick, I mean, it looked like you know, Matt's car didn't leave quite like it usually does. It kind of just drove out. So I don't know. Maybe a 60-foot wasn't quite what it normally is. But, yeah, I mean, he made a good run, but maybe not a great run for him.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I go back and look at the video, you can – first off, he got on the two-step right after he staged.
Right,
early. And I wasn't in yet. And so, I mean, I was still bumping in, and I wasn't in, you know, I didn't hold him out or anything. I was in a couple of seconds after him. But, you know, as the tree's coming down, his car kind of moves, and you kind of alluded to it in his brake pressure switch. But I want to say he probably left from a dead idle after that. And that's probably why it didn't leave as good as it probably should have, just because he was trying to catch it from going red. And so not only did he lose ET from being in deep, but he probably left from a dead idle as well.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I didn't ask that question, but but yeah.
Yeah, I just agree with Austin. It just looked like it didn't leave hard, and he was flustered on that, and that's probably why he was down a dime from his earlier runs, you know, so just nighttime and, you know, just a perfect setting for you.
Now tell us a little bit about the 000 light. I mean, I know you thought you probably had to go after it, but at the same time, you know, I've been in a situation, you don't want to be red, right? So did you chip it up? Did you try to make your light better? Or did you just figure that by hopping the car up and icing it and doing the oil that the car would react better?
Right. So, I guess I can go back a little bit. I actually ran Charlie second round and, I laid up a really good run. Go ahead, Charlie.
It wasn't much of a race.
I think I was a stellar 85. Really good run. Yeah, I was 90 and 6 above first round, and the guy was red on me. I made a horrible run. And I come back whatever day it was and run Charlie, and, you know, I hit the tree. I'm 20 and go one above and get past Charlie. And then I come back and ran Charlie's teammate. And
juice.
And then however many hours later, right, because that was after the pros. And so I was 22 on Charlie, and then after sitting around all day, I come up and I hit it. I'm 8. And so I was like, well, I don't really want to mess with the chip here. I said, I'll just let some air out of the front tires. I come back, I was 16. And so I want to say I let a little bit more air out after that, and I was 30, right? So then I never touched the front tires after that, and I was still at 3,000 right there. That's what I'd been at since class round 2 or 3 or something like that. And so I was at 3,000 there, and then in the semis against Eddie Brooks, I stayed at 3,000, stayed with all my tire pressures were all the same.
And
I got past
dark
him.
Dark right now?
Right, yeah, it's dark. But see, I open tree race. I actually do it probably incorrect. However, I follow them down instead of just staring at it. It's just what I've always done. And no blinders up or anything. And so – for me, I actually foot brake in the duster, too, because foot braking is way more natural to me. But a quadrajet will always be a quadrajet, and you can't ever get them to foot brake just about. So you almost have to two-step them. And so, you know, I go tonight, and I'm 50 in the semis and get past Eddie Brooks. And then for the final, I left the front tires alone. I chipped up from 3,000 to 3,400 and put 2 pounds of air in the back tires from 22 to 24. So I'm sitting in the lane, and Bo comes over to me because he was helping me kind of get it iced down. He goes, you do not want to give this thing away on the starting line. And so I chipped back down 200, which I went up 400, but then I went down 200, right? So after that, it ended up going up 200, and then I'm 000. So because he told me, he's like, that 2 pounds of air in the back, which I knew is going to make quite a bit of a difference up front. And so – like you said, now we're at dark. I've got the motor as cold as I can get it. I've got 2 more pounds of air in back tires. I've chipped up 200. You don't really know where your spot is anymore. And so when I hit it, I thought, oh, that seems okay. That seems like 20 or whatever. And then I knew I'd moved on him. And then when I got my time slip, I was just in disbelief that it was triple zero. Like I said, maybe the beam held up or something up there. Who knows?
Yeah, well, you were triple zero for class too, weren't you? One run.
Yeah, actually in second round of class, I was triple zero as well, and that's when I was at 3,200. And then I came back and ran Butcher, which he had me covered a tenth. I actually chipped back down to 3,000 after I was triple zero, and then I was like 18 or 20 or something like that. So, I actually had two triple zeros over the course of the weekend.
Wow, that's awesome. I saw the video that, you know, kind of went viral around the internet of the class final that I think Brian Lowe did, right?
What's the official count on all the memes so far? There's got to be 50 of them.
I think somebody shared a photo album with me because it's 2019. You can do that on phones now.
Yep.
And I think it's at 44.
It was pretty funny. Every day there was like two or three new ones. I was getting a good laugh out of some of them.
Oh, yeah. Some of those went way back in the archives.
Yep.
Now, this was win number 14, right?
Yeah, so it's win national win number 14. And the third in that car, surprisingly. Nine total in stock, but that's actually my third in that car, which I kind of, like I said, I ran that car 10 years ago. I actually won the 2009 and 2010 Cajun Sports in the same car. Back then, it had a red and white paint job on it. I want to say Brad Zaskowski won one of those years too in Superstock.
Yeah,
stock.
Yep.
And
I remember I was there. You won it, and Brad won it one of those years. Yep.
Yeah, and I was driving that car back then. And like I said, we ended up with the Duster at the end of 2010, and I've kind of been in it ever since. I did make one cameo appearance in the Camaro last year. To get horsepower put on the 300 horse, 350, and that's the story of me and the Camaro.
Nice, very nice. Now, so out of the 14 wins, where does this one rank?
It's probably up at the top. It's probably tied. It's like 1A and 1B. I'll say Indy's one. But in a second or a close second is probably my home event of Dallas in 2010. Just because it's home. And Dallas has, I don't know if y'all have been down here, but they have like bricks up by the starting line and they put a little plate on each of the bricks after you win. So it's just kind of cool. It's just a reminder of something you accomplished.
Yeah,
yeah, sure. I did. The one time I was in Dallas, I did see that, and I was telling one of the Edmonds, they make a cowboy hat for you or something if you win there too.
Right. Yeah. You get a black cowboy hat as well.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. It's really. I think everybody likes to win their home race probably the most, and then Indy,
yep.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is cool. Some of those traction, I know, like Sonoma, you get a bottle of wine. You know, Norwalk, you get the ice cream scoop, Dallas, a hat. Some of those deals are kind of neat. I wish every track would kind of have their own little unique, you know, special deal for the winners, you know. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially
yeah,
now you don't
really
get
cool.
medallions anymore.
Yeah, for sure. So, man, 14 wins. You've won Dallas. You've won Indy. What you got to go next?
Sorry, you cut out on me for a second there. What was that?
Yeah, so I said you've got 14 wins now. You've won Dallas. You've won Indy. You know, what other goals do you have, I guess, in Stock Eliminator or even Super Comp?
I think Vegas would be cool.
Okay, yeah, that's good.
And then the other one that was probably on my list, but now it's gone, would be the Bowling Green Sports National. I just think that's cool because it's the history of Bowling Green with the Sports Nationals and like the significance, like that was almost like mini Indy right there, you know, with the classrooms and all of that kind of stuff. And I thought that was kind of cool. And Columbus is further away from me than Bowling Green. So I doubt I'd venture up that way, but I thought Bowling Green was, was kind of cool. And you know, the Cajuns I always thought were a good time. I know Charlie came down there a few years.
That was my favorite, one of my favorite races. I ran up to Helms there one year. But I would go back to that race in a heartbeat, even though the last couple of times the facility was kind of getting a little run down since Pat left. But we always had such a good time there. The people were good, you know, between, you know, Hidalgo's and everybody cooking and having a good time. It's out in the middle of nowhere in Tucson. And that was a race I first started going to, I think, in 08 or 09. And it was always on the schedule every year just because it was really cool. I agree with you on that. That place was, it just had a really cool atmosphere to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's something when Fletcher would stop by there and race, you know, on his national tour, he would make sure and kind of stop by there and race Belrose, which I thought was cool because, I mean, it was a sports national, but it had a real big feel to it. I don't really know how to say it other than that.
Yeah, we'll see what Columbus feels like. You know, we had sport nationals at Columbus when it went away. Now it's back. The new owners have done some improvements. I haven't been there, but since they redid the track, they redid the staging lanes, they redid a little bit of the pits, I understand. Aaron, did you go there in the spring or not?
Yeah, I was there in the spring, and they've, you know, Columbus for many years had kind of gone downhill, and just they didn't put any tray when they owned it. They really didn't put any money into it.
It was a dump, let's be honest. You know?
Yeah, and, you know, the track surface started going downhill, but, you know, in the last probably 3 years, they've repaved the track. They've put a whole new, the staging lanes used to be like a, I don't even know what you'd call it. I mean, but you had to hang on to the car like at 10 mile an hour because it was so bumpy.
It was a roller coaster with potholes.
Yeah, it was bad. So they completely redid that, put up new fencing. They made substantial upgrades to the pits. And we were down there for the points meet in the spring. I guess that would have been, was that in April, May?
Yeah, April or May, somewhere around there.
But it was one of their first races of the year because we had a really rainy spring, obviously. So there's a little bit of confusion just with, you know, I don't think they'd run a race to that size yet with the new ownership group. So, you know, I'm hoping by now they've kind of got that part of it figured out. But, yeah, I mean, the track itself and pits and, you know, kind of facilities, you know, definitely a lot better. And, you know, I think if we can get good weather here in Ohio, and it's next weekend, so, and it's in the 80s, you know, upper 80s this week in Ohio, so if that kind of hangs around for another week, and we can have, you know, good weather, I think that will be a very well attended, it wouldn't be surprised if there's a bump in stock limited for sure. It could be a pretty cool race, so I think it'll be very weather dependent just this late in the year, I'm very much looking forward to it. And unlike Austin, it's about 150 miles for me, so that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. So they started giving away grading points for the guys that, you know, didn't get out maybe earlier in the year. They can go there. You know, you don't need a grading point to enter it anymore, and they give you one for attendance. So you give some guys that maybe have 3 or 4 grading points, you know, another opportunity to get one at the end of the year. So just kind of an added bonus.
Yeah, at that race, much like Born Dream was, you get guys that don't go to a ton of races that want to run class. They think that's cool, and that'll be one of the only races they come to all year. So, you know, I think it's cool. You get to see some cars you don't get to see so much on the kind of the national tour that we've become accustomed to. So I'm looking forward to it. So back to you, Austin. Obviously, congrats on a great weekend at Indy, or week. I guess you can't call it a weekend anymore. But, I mean, one thing that we talked a little bit off air, but, you know, this kind of got you up into, I think you're number 3 in the points in stock now, the national point standings after Indy. And I don't believe you were really even in the conversation so much before Indy. So, you know, you're only, you know, 4 or 5 rounds back, I think, from the lead now. You know, does it change your plans the rest of the year, or did you always kind of have the plan to chase it to the end?
No, yeah, I stick to my kind of 14 event schedule. I get a full slate, you know, 6 nationals, 8 divisionals, And I'm going to stick to that and get a full compliment there. But, you know, somebody asked me while I was in Indy, because I was sitting in a similar position in both cars, actually. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked me in Indy, well, you ran in for the world. I said, no, I said, really what I'm kind of focused on right now is I'd like to get to both cars in the top 10. I said, I think that's realistic, right? And
yep.
So, you know, I look after Indy because anyone who says they ain't counting points or they don't look, they're lying for the record. But I look after Indy and I was like, well, I've moved up quite a bit, you know, which there's some people hanging around there. I've got an opportunity, or a chance, I guess you could say. And I think coming out of Indy with a chance is all you can really ask for. Just period, every year, right?
Oh yeah, so absolutely.
I think, you know, I'll still go to the races that I'm planning to go to, which is going to be the Great Bend Divisional, and next weekend, I guess that is, September like 20th, 21st, something like that. I'll do that divisional for my last divisional, and then I'll do the Dallas National, and then I'm going to go to the Vegas National only. Unless for some reason I've got a reason to stay out in Vegas, which I'll have to see that, you know, with my work schedule and all of that. But, you know, that was my schedule at the beginning of the year, and I'm going to stick to that. And maybe I can put some points on the board and see where we end up. But, you know, it's been a couple of years since I've gotten the top 10 in stock. So I'm looking forward to hopefully getting back in the top 10 and carrying a single digit.
Well, I think you're obviously well on your way to doing that. You know, currently sitting in third. I think, you know, you've got a shot. I think Slate Cummings has a shot. He's got three nationals to go, and it looks like he's got a pretty strong divisional score, but got some early exits at the nationals, so he's got a pretty good shot. Allison Dahl, just bring her up. She's been really hot. I think she's won three of the Division I points meets in Stock Eliminator. I don't care who you are, that's hard to do. And she's got a monster divisional score as well. Three nationals to go, sitting about a round and a half behind you. So, you know, definitely, you know, three or four people that got a chance. And then don't count out Joe Santangelo. He's got, he's got 590 points, which usually is not enough to win. I think often you said you're a stats guy. You know, it seems like to me 650 is usually the number. But, you know, this year might be a little different.
Yeah, I'd say 650 is usually the number, you know. I mean, some years it's higher, some years it's lower. Like the year that I won, I want to say Drew Skillman had 680-something and got second. And so, I mean, it just varies. The year Brad Burton won his first world championship, I want to say it was like 601, 603, 611, something like that. It was one of those low years. But, yeah, like I said, my personal goal would be 650. The people that I kind of watch, right? So you alluded to Allison.
Yep.
Allison and Joe both lost first round over the weekend.
Yep.
Which helped. And again, any person that's chasing points, they know who and who's in what and who has done what. I don't care.
Absolutely.
Who you are. They're watching. And you know, Slate has a really good chance. His national score is lacking, I guess you would say. Or he's got room for improvement there. Same thing with Allison. I think she's got 230s on the board right now, through three races. So she's definitely got room for improvement there. And if Jimmy Hidalgo, I want to say he's coming to the Columbus Sports National. He's got quite a bit of races left. He may be a little bit further down your sheet.
Yeah,
but he's got a real good chance.
Yeah, Cooter always seems to be in that hunt, you know, every year in, year out. I mean, he's always a top 10 player, it seems like.
Yeah, and
yeah.
I want to say Chris Chaney was pretty far up there. For having what I'm going to call your minimum races at like three nationals and five divisionals. The thing that may be hurting him a little bit is I think his father has been in a little bit of bad health shape. So They weren't able to come to Indy, and they didn't go to Earlville over this past weekend. So I think Russ hasn't been doing real well, so that could hurt him a little bit.
Stock's
pretty wide open.
Yeah,
I think it's good that you plan to go to the 14 to start the year. I think that definitely gives you a good shot every year. I think, you know, when you look at somebody like Allison Dahl, logistically it's going to be hard for her to go to three more nationals. I mean, without, you know, significant travel. Obviously, they got Maple Grove coming up this weekend.
She'll go to Maple Grove. She'll go to Sports Nationals and probably Charlotte.
Yeah, I forgot about Charlotte. So actually, that's not as bad for her. So you're right.
Yeah,
Charlotte. So that's not as bad as it can be.
Yeah, I would think that that's where they're going.
Yeah, I keep forgetting about Columbus being decently close for the Division I gang.
Yeah,
it's not far at all. You're right.
And you got the St. Louis race also. That's not a horrible tell. It's probably 14 hours, but it's not the end of the world.
Right, yeah, and I like that race a lot. I've been probably the last 5 or 6 years. The reason I'm not going this year is because I don't think I've ever gotten out of, like, second or third round. So, I keep abusing yourself. I'm going to, you know, coast 7 hours further out west and go to Vegas instead for Halloween.
Well, hey, Vegas is on your list, right? So maybe we can knock two birds, one stone, right? So awesome. I also just wanted to touch on the winner in Superstock, Charlie. I don't know if you want to talk about that a little bit.
Tyler Cottrell won. He's got a new Copo. You know, normally runs stock. He was doing double duty, I think, also running the Copo in stock and then the Copo in Superstock. You know, drove average to decent, you know, got lucky when he needed to and, you know, turned on 7 wind lights. You know, Indy's, you know, as awesome as though it's a marathon. I mean, you know, from qualifying Wednesday, class Thursday, we sat around, didn't do nothing Friday and Saturday, you know, then ran, you know, one round on Sunday and the rest on Monday. So, I mean, it's a lot can change in 5 days. And, you know, he came out on top. He didn't have an easy road to hoe. Had some decent lights, had some not decent lights, had some average lights, but, you know, his candle came on, and that's half the battle most of the time is getting the wind light to turn on. So, and I don't know, was that Tyler's first or second one?
First national event win.
That's what I was thinking, that was his first one. So, and I believe that car's a stick also. I know a stocker is, or was.
I'm not sure. I know they've had a lot of sticks in the past. And you know, Tyler's not somebody that, I mean, they don't go to the 14 races like, you know, Austin just talked about every year. So, it was impressive to kind of see them win. And hey, a win at Indy, no matter how you get it, it's a win at Indy. So,
correct.
I saw him and, you know, I was getting ready to do field check after our final. And, you know, he had pulled up because they ran the Superstock final not long after ours, right? So he pulled up, and, you know, I see Tyler, you know, like I said, I run a lot of Division V races, and
yeah,
he comes down to four some. And so I kind of give him a hug and told him congrats, and I said, not a bad way to end after the way you started. And the reason I said that is because he ran Randy Lynn first round of stock, and she was not great on the tree, and he turned it red. In which I'm good friends with Randy Lynn. So,
yep,
you know, she'll tell you that as well. And he told me, because I was ready to drive my car off the end of the track right there. And so he comes back, and I kid you not, and I want to say I don't want to speak for him, but I'm pretty sure it's a crazy story of, like, his grandfather came to Indy, like, 40 or 50 years to the exact day that Monday happened to be. And I want to say his grandfather has passed away since then, but I don't know if it was at Indy or past that, right? So
okay. The
only reason I say this is because there's, like, some divine intervention going on here. And he after he goes red in stock, he goes to super stock and has 6 red lights in a row, and the guy in the final is 100 against him. And so, like, I just think that's really cool that, you know, something – a story like that with his grandfather, and I don't think he'd been to Indy very much, if any at all, and something like that happened. I think it's really cool, and it's kind of a little bit of a shame that we don't get to hear that story firsthand on, like, a, you know, a Parade of Champions or a National Dragster article or something like
right.
that.
Yeah, and that's what really, you know, not to change the subject, but that's what really sucks about National Dragster out here. You used to get all these, you know, two or three paragraph little flip stories from everybody when they won, you know, kind of something a little bit personal. And now that touch is kind of gone. It's basically, what, a contingency deal and then maybe a half a page paragraph about something and some pictures. I mean, it's...
Right.
You know, it's a shame that we don't get that, you know, because it seems like every time you catch yourself reading, there was something you didn't know about somebody or this or that, or, you know, you'd read it and the person that it had won is like, you know, I don't know nothing about this car, I just drive it or something. You'd think, well, how, you know, the old man works on it or...
Right.
You know, little bits of information that we don't get now, you know. Not that it means a whole lot, but it's just kind of interesting to put a story with a face.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's part of the reason why you and I did this podcast. You know, we obviously didn't do it to get rich. And I think we're just trying
to promote
Stock and Super Stock. And you know, it's been a lot of fun getting to interview great people like Austin here. So.
Yep.
All right. So let's touch on one more thing here. I told Austin this would be like 20, 30 minutes max. And we're like hour and 40 minutes in, to be fair here.
I did talk to Paula Cotton at Norwalk, and she's like, man, I really like it when you guys have like ones that are hour and a half or 2 hours, because when we're driving across country, you know, we can listen to this thing and it burns up time real quick, you know, if we're listening. So the longer ones are better for some people.
I've had a lot of people tell me that, like, you should do it every day, and I'm like, you know how long it takes?
Hey. Aaron's got a hard enough time getting me to do one every 10 days, let alone every day.
Right.
Well, we're just making this podcast as long as Indy was.
Yeah, right. this is the Indy podcast. We're gonna make it long. So
that's right. But we gotta make it for Paula and Mike, because they give everybody koozies at Indy. So this one's for Paula and Mike.
Yep.
Awesome. Okay. So two more things we'll talk about real quick. One, we talked about the stock limiter points chase. You know, and talking to you, Austin. Let's talk a little about Super Stock. You got Santangelo again leading it, 614, but he's about finished up. He's got one more national to go to. Probably go to Maple Grove this weekend, I would guess. I think he's got a win to improve. So it's gonna be very hard for him to improve in Superstock. Rampy is completely claimed out behind him. And then you got, you know, three or four guys that can make a run at it. You know, you got Kyle Rizzoli at 570. Ricky Decker at 570 as well, with only three national events. And then you got Steve Camello at 529 in a Hemi car, remember? I didn't stutter. In a Hemi car.
A stick Hemi car.
Yeah.
That's right. He's having a good year. He won a points meet here not too long ago, I believe.
Yeah, so.
He's had a very good year.
He's a driver, buddy.
Yeah, so I think either Kyle, Ricky, or Steve, I mean, they got to be the guys that are in the hunt. You know, I think it was Monty Joe Bogan told me a long time ago, I'd rather be in front than chasing, because they still got to win the rounds. And he's right? I mean, Joe set the points out there. He's got it. You know, Ricky and those guys got to go after him. And, you know, it definitely, as Austin said earlier, you know, if you say you don't look at the points, you're lying. You're looking at them. You know, Ricky knows that he's got to win five rounds to go around Joe. And, you know, I'm guessing he's not going to get too much sleep the next few months. But, you know, it definitely gets harder to win rounds when there's a lot of pressure on. So I guess we'll see how that goes out. Do you guys see it any differently, or anybody else that I'm missing here?
No, not really. That kind of sums it up.
Yeah, I mean, you hit kind of the three that I'm looking at in Ricky and Camella and Rizzoli. Although I guess I don't love Rizzoli's chances, because I think he's working on like all third rounders or something like that. Camella's probably got the best chance, really.
Yeah, I agree.
But Ricky, I mean, he's got some second rounders to work on.
Yeah, I mean,
favorite...
Ricky, if Ricky can go through and snag a win, buddy, he moves up about 75 points. I mean, that's a huge jump, man, if he can just get it done.
Right. So he's trying to do two things there, right? So he wins and he takes over the national points lead, probably, if he wins a national event. And he also wins his first national event.
We've talked about that on here before. I mean,
there's a guy
who's done everything but that, which somebody told me he had like 15 or 16 national event runner ups. I mean, just the odds of that somebody's going to break or go right against you. I mean, it just, you know, I'm still having a hard time wrapping my head around that stat.
Oh yeah, it's crazy. It's nuts. I think there's three guys in super stock that have won world championships without winning a super stock quali, and I think there's one or two in stock. I think it's one. So
yeah.
It's not like I said. If I'm gonna handicap it, I guess Ricky would probably be my bet, but I probably don't love it either. So
yeah,
I think it's gonna be real close. I think super stock's gonna be one of those years where it's kind of low. I think 630 may get it done in super stock.
Yeah, I agree. And just looking this a little further on my computer, I mean, you got Stanfield he's still in the running. Vic Penrod, he's mathematically got a pretty good shot. You know, if he gets
right, Penrod didn't qualify at Indy, by the way.
He's got a 10 in there then, right?
Yeah, he didn't qualify.
He doesn't have to take that though.
Right.
Well,
no.
He's only got three nationals. So if he's got a 10, it's not showing the detail for me right now for some reason, but that means that he's really got, you know, as soon as he shows up to, say, St. Louis, you know, he's really got 20 more points. So he's kind of up there with Camilla and those guys. So.
Right. I think he won Chicago, and then he came back the very next week and runnered up at Topeka.
Topeka, right.
I mean, he's still got two very good claims, right, at a national. But,
yep.
I think he was driving Bobby Dennis's what is that? I guess it's Achieva
or one of them. Yeah, Achieva.
Yeah, Achieva. At Indy, and it didn't qualify. But I forgot about Penrod being down there a little bit.
What's it going to take? The 5 1/4 get you in the top 10 this year in both or not?
I would probably say so. Stock, it may be a little bit higher because you've already got a few people over 525. Actually, you know what? I did look at Superstock the other day. I think Superstock's not going to take a lot to win, but I think it's going to take a lot to get in the top 10. Like,
yeah,
it may be one of those years that 550 gets you in, or that's what you have to get in the top 10.
Yeah.
Because I would say most of the time it hangs between that 520, 530 range to get, you know, a number 10 or 9.
Right, and one other person that's down there a little bit, and he's got a full national left, is Jacob Pitt. He's at like 488 with a full national left in Superstock.
Yeah, you're right. He's obviously
a
great racer
in there.
Yeah, so Jacob just lives probably 30 minutes from me. He'll be at St. Louis and Dallas, so we'll see.
He normally does pretty good at Dallas too, if my memory's correct.
Yeah, absolutely. He's drove that super stocker really well this year. If it wasn't for Rampy in our division this year, he probably would have won the division, but Rampy had some good races in there, and won our division in super stock, more than likely. I mean, we're not done yet, but I think he's got a pretty good stranglehold on.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. All right, guys. The one last thing I wanted to talk about, which has been named the Weekday Nationals. This past week, we ran the rainout from Norwalk National Event in July. Charlie and I were both on site. They ran the race Thursday and Friday. I think, you know, the couple things I want to bring up, I think that Norwalk, you know, went above and beyond just like they always do and did a great job hosting the event. They basically let you park as soon as you got there. Some of the guys, you know, coming from Indy didn't really have to wait too long, got parked on the asphalt, let you plug in, did electric. They did a free test and tune session on Wednesday for anybody. So you could basically get as many runs as you wanted. I thought that was a really heads-up move from them and a pretty awesome deal. I'd say the other thing they did that was just, I mean, they don't do this in any trail races. Any crew member, any fan, free to get in. So I thought that was pretty cool as well. And for a race that was on Thursday and Friday, there was actually a fair amount of people walking around. Obviously not like like a normal national event, but I mean there was definitely people walking around. So I'd say, I think probably a couple hundred people at least there.
Thursday, yeah, come Friday, on, both days. The one thing I will say, you know, Bader went above and beyond. You know, parking was easy. Everything was easy getting out of the gate, scheduling real good. One thing I will say about, you know, Bill Bader Jr., you know, as most people know, you know, Don Rohde passed away here a couple weeks ago and they did a little memorial. Bill actually was the one doing the talking and stuff, and that was really, really cool to see a track owner come out, and, you know, there was probably 100 people around there for a little memorial, and he talked for probably 10, 15 minutes, did a great job. I mean, just, it shows how connected he is with the sportsman racer. I know Joe Buchanan drove the car down one last time, and it was just really touching to see a guy that owns the place, and he came out and, you know, took time out of his night and stuff to do that. And even on Friday, I don't know if you saw it, Aaron, or not, but he was actually running the water box, you know, most of the day on Friday, you know, dressed up just like his guys he had paid. So, you know, my hat's off to him. Did a great job under the circumstances we were dealt. You know, I don't know how we could have done it any different. You know, it does suck coming right from India to there, basically, but, you know, he was right down in there, short staff, working with his guys, making sure we all had the best track possible.
Yeah, I mean, the track was good. I did want to touch on the Don Rohde Memorial. You know, Don's wife had told Bill she thought maybe, you know, 10, 15 people would attend, and they just kind of wanted to do one final pass, you know, one final run in the car, you know, that sort of thing. And he had passed away a month or so ago. But I would say probably more than 100 people showed up. I would say, you know, if there was 220 racers at the event, I bet you more than half were there. It was really pretty cool. And Bill spoke. Obviously, he's a great MC, and the RFC chaplain spoke. And then Joe Buchanan jumped in a car he'd never driven. That's, you know, a 270-some-inch, you know, small block, which if, you know, I've got a modified motor, and they're not the easiest thing in the world to do a burnout with, especially something that small. And he did about, I'd say, 9,500-plus, 330-foot burnout. And it was one of the cooler things I've seen. It was really cool to see all the people come together and kind of support, you know, Don's family. And it was a pretty cool way to kind of send them off. And I tell you what, Don was a racer, and he'd have been proud.
Yep. No, I agree.
And that was Thursday night. And then Friday we ran the entire race. The weather was beautiful both days. And John D. Bartolomello won. I butchered the name a little bit. Johnny D. Won in Superstock over Keith Lynch in the final. And in Stock Eliminator was Chuck Beach. Got the win over Jeff Myers. It looks like Jeff, I think he crept through the beams or something going on in the final, kind of gave Chuck an easy win. But, you know,
yeah, Chuck was kind of all over the place. He had some good life early on. Dodged a really interesting bullet third round. You know, he'd been running dialing 1090, and they put 1040 up on the scoreboard, and his opponent went red to him. You know, he had to run cotton heads up for the buy into the final. So, you know, he had a lot of things really swing his way, and then, you know, Jeff kind of rolled the beams in the final there and gave him the easy win.
Yeah, so, you know, it was a lot of good racing. There was some really tight races. There were some guys that got lucky here and there. But I there was a couple 00 dead-on runs that you went back to the trailer. So it was a pretty cool event. Definitely the most unique national event I've ever been to. But I think, you know, NHRA / Bill Bader and the Summit facility there did their best to make it as cool as possible for the situation. And, you know, I stayed till the end, and I think we left it, I don't know, 3:30, 4 o'clock, and it was pretty early. Everybody was over, so.
Yeah, I mean, we pretty much ran, what, 5 hours each day, you'd say, Aaron?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, they definitely probably could have done
9 to 2.
Yeah, they definitely probably could have done the whole thing in one day. I mean, there was only 200-ish cars total. But they did it in 2 days, and they took their time, and it was kind of a, let's call it a relaxed atmosphere. You know, made for a nice 2 days. You know, the only bad thing was it was, you know, the old weekday national, so Thursday and Friday, and you know, that was kind of a weird deal to be home Friday night from a national event. But I guess that happens sometimes if you don't do very good, too, so.
Yeah. So. But no, I didn't think it was that bad. You know, it was laid back, like you said. My only bitch was the ice cream was only open for about an hour and a half one day. It wasn't open both days. So I got hosed out some ice cream, which isn't the end of the world for me. You all know if I don't eat the ice cream. So.
Let's say, Charlie, you're putting the winter weight on a little early this year, you know.
Hey, what are you talking about? I'm down 5 pounds.
Okay. All right, cool. So that was the Norwalk summary. This weekend we have Maple Grove coming up, and the weekend after we have the Columbus Sports Nationals. I don't know if there's any points meets coming up in the next 2 weeks. I don't know. Austin might know. When's Topeka? Is it coming up?
Yeah, so Great Bend, it's probably the same weekend as Columbus Sports, like the 21st, something like that. I want to say, just because I have a bunch of buddies in Division Six, I want to say Woodburn is this weekend in Division Six. That's in Woodburn, Oregon. And I feel like Phoenix is coming up in Division Seven, but that may be in October. The Division Four schedule is done. And then 5 has Great Bend left, but I don't know what else. I feel like there's got to be a Division II race coming up.
Well, yeah, they got the makeup of Earlville also at Grand Bend.
Yeah, so I want to say that they completed third round of a bunch of classes, but Stock and Superstock both had third round completed, so there's probably 8 to 10 cars left in both of those classes, 8 to 12,
yeah.
Something like that. So they'll complete that, and I saw that today. They're going to complete that Friday of Great Bend.
Okay, awesome. Well, I think what that tells you is you got a lot of racing coming up in the next 2-3 weeks. And I think we talked again on the podcast. These point situations may be a little further along. Might have a little bit better chance here if somebody gets hot or somebody does good over these few races. So. That'll be exciting to follow. And, you know, I just want to thank Austin again here for jumping on tonight. You know, sorry for the length of time, but you've been a good sport about it. And, you know, it's pretty awesome to talk about U.S. Nationals win. Not only winning the U.S. Nationals, but doing it the way you did, you know, in a car you weren't super familiar with, winning 2 heads-up rounds. You know, pretty good story for sure. So thanks for coming on and you know, telling your story. And I just want to wish you good luck the remainder of the season. You obviously, you know, in the hunt, in the national point standings, and would love nothing more than to get you back on here at the end of the year and talk some more. So, good luck.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I appreciate it, and I really enjoyed it tonight, even if it was getting closer to bedtime here.
Well, thanks for coming on, man, and congratulations again. So.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks, man, and seriously, good luck.
That concludes the Class Racing Podcast. Please remember to visit racetoolsdirect.com for all of your tools and equipment needs.